Why didn't I see this before? Did God change the text overnight? The answer, of course, was not rooted in the preparations for a test, but rather in practical rabbinics. Why would I ever remember such a law concerning filling a mikveh with ice or snow while living in Israel? To be precise, in Israel, what ice and snow? Welcome to Jerusalem 365, episode 48, The Snow That Saved Jerusalem. I'm Meir Soloveitchik. It is one of the most famous military blunders in the history of the world. Napoleon Bonaparte chose to attack Russia, and in the end, his forces were destroyed by the fierce snow, wind, and cold of the Russian winter. Of course, the essence of Napoleon's mistake is often misunderstood. It is assumed by many that Bonaparte never took the winters of the East into account, but this is untrue. As my friend, the great historian Andrew Roberts, explains in his writings and his lectures, Napoleon was all too aware of the weather conditions near Moscow, but he had assumed that he would engage the Russians in battle immediately after crossing into the Tsar's territory. Instead, the Tsar's forces kept withdrawing and withdrawing, all the way to Moscow, drawing the French deeper and deeper into their own territory. And in the end, it was indeed the winter that destroyed the French army, for more members of the French forces were felled by frostbite and famine and typhus and the like than by battle itself. Snow, winter, frost was an essential element in the French defeat. What, however, about battles in the land of Israel? Of course, snow there is so rare that we would be surprised to learn that it played a military role in any way whatsoever. But it did. And in a moment critical to Jewish history, as well as to the future of biblical belief throughout the world. And if this snow was simultaneously so significant and so unexpected, then one could only ascribe the event to providence, like so many other events in the history of the world's most sacred city. Classical history of Greece and Rome is always complicated, but that is especially true when it comes to the series of events that took place in the time period that we are discussing now, events that had so important an impact on Judea. Let us review. The king of the Syro-Greek Seleucid dynasty during the Hanukkah story, when Mattathias revolted and Judah cleansed the temple, was Antiochus IV, Antiochus Epiphanes. The Battle of the Maccabees continued against Antiochus' nephew, Demetrius I. It was battling Demetrius' forces that Judah the Maccabee died, and his leadership of the Judean traditionalist forces passed to his youngest brother, Jonathan. Then, as we mentioned yesterday, Demetrius' claim to the throne was challenged by a purported son of Antiochus by the name of Alexander. By cultivating the rivalry between them, Jonathan was able to secure recognition from both of them of his right to serve as high priest in Jerusalem. That is where we left off. Now here is where it gets really complicated, and don't worry, you can always listen to this podcast again, and there will not be a quiz. Alexander defeated and killed Demetrius I in battle in 150 BCE and claimed the Seleucid throne, continuing to recognize Jonathan as high priest in Jerusalem. In further recognition of Alexander's kingship, the ruler of Alexandria, Ptolemy VI, gave his daughter as a wife to Alexander. Alexander's claim to the throne was then challenged by Demetrius' son, Demetrius II. This Demetrius also threatened Jonathan in Judea as part of his assault on the Seleucid territory. And Jonathan, utilizing the strategic cleverness that we have already seen, defeated Demetrius' general Apollonius and, famously, destroyed a pagan temple dedicated to the god Dagon that stood in the Holy Land in Ashkelon. Meanwhile, Ptolemy VI of Alexandria had a falling out with his son-in-law, Alexander, and not only switched his support to Demetrius II, he also took away his daughter from Alexander and gave her to Demetrius instead, and then defeated and killed in battle Alexander, his former son-in-law. Thus, the Seleucid Empire was ruled by Demetrius II, the new son-in-law of Ptolemy in Alexandria. But wait, there's more. Following the death of Alexander, a Seleucid general named Diodotus Tryphon, known as Trypho, claimed to act on behalf of Alexander's young son, whose name was also Antiochus, using that as an excuse to overthrow Demetrius II and to himself take control of the Seleucid kingdom, though he, Trypho, was not a descendant of the Seleucids at all. Trypho then invited Jonathan from Jerusalem to engage in a parley with him, but this was all in deceit. Trypho actually seized Jonathan and took him hostage in the city of Ptolemais, First Maccabees tells us what happened. Quote, Jonathan went out to meet him with 40,000 picked fighting men, and he came to Beth-shan. When Trypho saw that he had come with a large army, he was afraid to raise his hand against him. So he received him with honor and commended him to all his friends, and he gave him gifts and commanded his friends and his troops to obey him as they would himself. Then he said to Jonathan, Why have you wearied all these people when we are not at war? Dismiss them now to their homes and choose for yourself a few men to stay with you and come with me to Ptolemais. I will hand it over to you as well as the other strongholds and the remaining troops and all the officials and will turn round and go home, for that is why I am here. Jonathan trusted him and did as he said. He sent away the troops and they returned to the land of Judah. He kept with himself 3,000 men, 2,000 of whom he left in Galilee, while 1,000 accompanied him. But when Jonathan entered Ptolemais, the men of Ptolemais closed the gates and seized him, and all who had entered with him they killed with the sword. End quote. Thus was Jonathan taken hostage, all the more shocking considering how wily Jonathan was known to be. This left only one surviving Maccabean brother, Simon Shimon, desperate to rescue Jonathan but facing a problem of his own, that Trypho then sent his Seleucid army to conquer Jerusalem. As Maccabees tells us, quote, After this Trypho came to invade the country and destroy it, and he circled around by the way of Adora, but Simon and his army kept marching along opposite him to every place he went. End quote. This, ladies and gentlemen, brings us to the moment on which everything would turn. Maccabees further informs us, quote, So Trypho got all his cavalry ready to go, but that night a very heavy snow fell, and he did not go because of the snow. He marched off and went into the land of Gilead. When approached Bethcama, he killed Jonathan, and he was buried there. Then Trypho turned back and departed to his own land. End quote. Thus, thanks to a snowstorm, the assault of the Syro-Greeks against the Maccabees was halted. Jonathan was killed by Trypho, but Jerusalem was independent of the Seleucids. The remaining Hasmonean brother, Shimon, was recognized as the leader of Jerusalem itself. Thus Maccabees again. And the Jews and their priests decided that Simon should be their leader and high priest forever, until a trustworthy prophet should arise, and that he should be governor over them, and that he should take charge of the sanctuary and appoint men over its tasks, and over the country, and the weapons and the strongholds, and that he should take charge of the sanctuary, and that he should be obeyed by all. End quote. For the first time since the fall of Jerusalem at the hands of Nebuchadnezzar, for the first time in hundreds of years, Jerusalem was under independent Jewish leadership. Shimon was recognized as both high priest and political leader, governor or ethnarch of Jerusalem, independent of any empires. We will discuss tomorrow whether Shimon should have accepted both the political position of ethnarch as well as the high priesthood. But for now, we must note how politically this moment marks the success of the Maccabean rebellion, a success that has enormous import for the future of faith. Had snow not kept Trypho away, and had the new Seleucid ruler succeeded in conquering Jerusalem, then all that the Hasmoneans, colloquially called the Maccabees, had fought for would have been for naught. The final Hasmonean, Simon Shimon, would have been executed. Thus, this was no mere snowstorm, as on it hinged the future not only of the Jewish faith, but of the entire future of monotheism. In my Tikva Sacred Time presentation on Hanukkah, I noted an article by the writer Christopher Hitchens, which was titled Ba Hanukkah. The article was composed with the same bigoted sentiment that marked most of Hitchens' writings about faith. But in the essay, Hitchens makes the point that had the Maccabees failed, had Hellenism won, then monotheism would not have survived. Hitchens contends that this is why he does not like Hanukkah, because were there no story of the Hasmoneans, then there would be no Judaism, no Christianity, no Islam. Reflecting on this, we realize that while Hitchens, of course, is entirely wrong in his attitude toward faith, the larger point is that without Hanukkah, there would only have been a pagan world, one devoid of monotheism. But that, contra Hitchens, is precisely why we celebrate the Hasmonean story. Hitchens' hatred of Hanukkah allows us to understand why the story of the Hasmonean achievement of independence from paganism, from Hellenism, which allowed them to preserve their purification of the temple, is one of the most significant moments in the history of the world. And this achievement may well have hinged on a sudden blizzard in the Holy Land. As such, it is not too much to see in this snowstorm something miraculous, significant not only for the Jewish people, but for monotheists around the world. And we might note, as an interesting aside, that whereas for much of military history, snow seemed to have been a symbol of doom and defeat, In the Bible, snow is a symbol of purity, of a cleansing from sin. Hence the biblical verse, "If your sins are as scarlet, they shall be made white as snow." It is therefore poetic, symbolically sublime, that the Maccabees, who dedicated themselves to the purification of Jerusalem from paganism, should have ultimately triumphed thanks to a miraculous snowstorm that suddenly struck the Holy Land. And pondering this fact should increase our own wonder at their story and at Jewish history itself. There's a very interesting article written by Rabbi Y.C. Grunstein describing his work as a rabbi in Halifax, Nova Scotia. Ordained in Israel, he was serving Jews in far north North America, or as one might call them, the frozen chosen. One day, Rabbi Grunstein describes, after a snowstorm and following repairs to the community's mikveh or ritual bath, the frigid weather stopped the flow of rainwater into the mikveh. Natural water was necessary in order for the mikveh to be made valid, and the rabbi suddenly realized that the solution could be found in the snow that was abundant everywhere. The snow could be used to supply the mikveh. How this works is beyond the scope of our subject today, but the rabbi's reflection about using snow for the ritual pool is very relevant. He writes, after this realization struck him, quote, "How could I forget? After all, to pass the 6 smicha ordination exams of the chief rabbinate of Israel, one is tested on this chapter thoroughly and must know it virtually by heart. Why didn't I see this before? Did God change the text overnight?" The answer, of course, was not rooted in the preparations for a test, but rather in practical rabbinics. Why would I ever remember such a law concerning filling a mikveh with ice or snow while living in Israel? To be precise, in Israel, what ice and snow? End quote. So the rabbi writes in an article that is very interesting when it comes to the study of Jewish law. And the rabbi's reflection also allows us to add to our own wonder at this Maccabean story. For, as he put it, in Israel, what ice and snow? He reminds us how unusual snow is in Israel and how wondrous it is that there was at one critical moment an important snowstorm in the land of Israel on which may have hinged the fate of faith itself, as well as the ultimate purification of Jerusalem from paganism. Throughout history, so many military commanders bestrode the world, but they did not last. As Yogi Berra supposedly said, even Napoleon had his Watergate. And as important as the winter in the East may have been in impacting Napoleon's aims and in affecting the future of Europe, in the history of the world, there may have been one snowstorm in the Middle East that was even more influential. It was certainly more miraculous, a snowstorm that impacted the story of monotheism itself. This is Meir Soloveitchik, looking forward to learning together tomorrow. Signing off.